right, welcome. Tonight is January 5th, 2019. And we are, the fifth in the lecture on the 1500s in Europe. So last week we started talking about Poland. And basically what we basically did is like more of the history of Poland. We spoke about some of the kings and the princes, and we spoke about how they invited the Jews and the laws, legislation that they made that was very good for the Jews, pro-Jewish, and when the rest of Europe was being very, I guess you'd call it anti-Semitic, or very harsh on the Jews with blood libels and expulsions, and in Poland things are they're opening up and they're being very kind and very open and inviting for Jews. So that's what happened. People came and they started moving to Poland. So today I wanted to just do more. Again, it's maybe a little bit of a review of things we said, but I wanted to take a look at the Jewish life in Poland, because you know, even today, you know, we people still say, oh, Poland, the old way it was, the shtetl, the old Poland, oh, that's the way, that was great, so to speak. And I think I grew up, maybe everybody else here grew up with Fiddler on the Roof, you know, that was the, you know, just going back, and that was the, not that it was a good movie or anything, it had plenty of, you know, bad messages, but that was the scene that they seemed to take, and it was for the many part very positive, at least for the first 150 years for the Jews. Again, we mentioned this last time, early settlement, there were Jews as early as the 11th century. It started with the Crusades in 1096, 1099, when the Europe was overrun by the People's Crusade. They went from town to town, just destroying town to town. So that's already, it started. People started leaving, and they started going to Poland. In 1264, we also mentioned, was one of the first charters that was set up by the king for real rights, protection rights for the Jews, something that other countries really did not have. Spain at this point was still pretty good, but Spain was, you know, very, very... it was very a good haven for the Jews, but that's going to start to change as the Christian reconquest of Spain, and up until 1391, from 1391 to 1492, the last 100 years was just when Spain was finished with. Yes?
What made Poland, or I guess any other country for that matter, more welcoming to the Jews? That other countries had vomit them out.
Okay. So, question is what made Poland very inviting for the Jews? And the truth is, really, every country, when they first start, they invite the Jews in because, I guess, the Jews were like middlemen. They were merchants, and the leaders know that if you want to have a country, a strong country, a prosperous country, you need a good infrastructure. You need to be able to have businesses. You need to there has to be money. There has to be money that is able to flow. Have to be That's what the Jews were. The Jews were money lenders. Jews were also merchants. Jews would do business with Jews in other countries. You know, so they already had an international connection. You know, so they would tap in on that resource. Jews were also, and I'm thinking about Poland and everywhere in the very beginning, you never had to worry about Jews taking over the country. Because that's not what Jews were choosing. In no way, shape, or form did they ever want to say, hey, you know what? Hey, Poland looks good. Let's revolt and we'll run Poland. They never had to worry, suspect that Jews would overcome revolt and take over the country. Jews were very pacifist by nature. And they were smart, and they brought many benefits. It was like in many areas, they were the middle class, especially as Poland became with serfs and nobles. So you had the very, very big gap in between the people. So the Jews were the ones to fill in that that which was needed economically.
Okay, so the other countries that through the mouth, through the ground,
right,
the other oppressions, what happened there?
Great, so what happens? What happens is the right, so this is a great idea to have just a lecture on what is a general thing, because what you're asking, this has repeated itself in history. So what happens is the country starts to mature, and they start to get the serfs start to become, there starts to become a middle class, and that middle class clashes with the Jews. Why do we need them? We can do it also. Then you also have to throw in the religious aspect, the church. The church always was negative to the Jews, anti. So it just depends how much and how much power they had and they yielded, you know. And eventually, it became the church would become more hostile to the Jews as time went on. So as time went on, that's it. The Jews found themselves in a country and. That would be, didn't need their services as much. Plus, the church would be against them, and they would turn the populace against the Jews as well. And then eventually they would have to, that's it, they would be thrown out.
But Poland was also a very strong Roman Catholic.
Yes, but Poland was probably one of the last countries in Europe to become Christian. I mean, it didn't happen until the 1100s. So until that time, there may have been Christians there, but it wasn't a Christian country. So therefore, you know, the Jews did not have, the church did not have as much influence in Poland in the very beginning, you know, when the Jews started to started to come there. Also, in the very beginning, you had the nobles were into making Poland great. And therefore, they were working together, you know, as a nation to make Poland into a great nation. That would stop. You know, there's going to be something, one major thing that happens in Poland that's going to turn everything, just make Poland one of the harshest places for the Jews, and that's going to be Gzeres Tachfetat, that's the Chmielnytsky's uprising, if I'm saying his name correctly, and that's going to. That's gonna just start a reversal of everything for the Jews in Poland, and they're not going to be as rich in the overpopulation, and the nobles are not going to be as protective, and the church is going to get stronger, and they're going to be invaded. Well, even may get to it, invaded by other countries, so the Jews are not going to fare well after 1648. As they did beforehand. But right now we're in the beginning. We're still 1264. More charters were granted in the 1300s and 1500s. And when you have pogroms all elsewhere, and expulsions, especially the 14th century, the 1300s for Europe in general was a bad century. And for the Jews in particular, it was bad. In 1348, you had the Black Plague. And that decimated up to a quarter, a third, some people even say a half of the population of Europe. And so the Jews that did not die of the plague, they would die, many of them died of the pogroms, because the Christians blamed the Jews for poisoning the wells. So, like, you know, it just, that was very, very bad overall for the Jews there. For some reason, the Black Plague did not affect Poland. Poland somehow was spared of the Black Plague. Okay, what was there? But mainly, I guess, most of the Jews, at least in the beginning, came from Germany. So it shared its, the language was German or really Yiddish. It all came, you know, the people that settled there felt that they were German Jews, and they had the German customs. So basically, that continued from there. language is Yiddish. We spoke a little bit about Yiddish. It was between a Slav and Aramaic and Hebrew and Germany. It was a mix of it all, and it comes out Yiddish. Of course, Minhag Ashkenaz, and okay. And by 1500, there were 50,000 Jews who were in Poland, and these were people who were quoted as saying, "Pinchas HaKaretz, Poland is exile less bitter than anywhere else." Savurim, they say, the Aboshta have a leka galuta. Here, there's no gullus here. And also the word Poland, they got from Polin. Lin means to rest, to live. So Po here, Po is here. Here we will rest. Here we will rest. And again, for the first 150 years, it was very, very good for the Jews. It's by 1648. This is the year of the Chmielnytskyi's uprising. There was a 500,000 Jews there. They say about a half to three quarters of the Jews in the world lived in. Does it make sense? There's only 1 million Jews in the world, maybe. Quite a number of the Jews of the world lived in Poland, became for sure the largest Jewish community in all the world. Well, there was no Jews in Western Europe anymore, right? England kicked out all their Jews, France kicked out all their Jews, Germany, it had many expulsions, most of the Jews were gone from there. So you had Turkey, everything, all the Jews were moving to the east. Turkey had a large amount of Jews, and Poland. I mean, there were still Jews in Germany, because Germany wasn't one big nation. France was one nation under one king, and when the king said goodbye to the Jews, that means goodbye to Jews everywhere. Germany had little, like, principalities, so you could have a few princes kicking the Jews out of one area, so they just would have to go to another area. They had the, there was a, the kings and the princes, they had, they gave the, like, rights, they gave some sort of a ruling rights to the Jews. Many of the lands where the shtetls started were lands that belonged to these nobles, and they either leased or gave land to Jews for them to settle. And the shtetl, I guess, is a certain area which is mostly Jews. I guess it would be helpful if you had at least one Shabbos guy, you know, helping there or whatever. But most of the shtetlach, they started on Poland lands, and they were given permission by the nobles. Noble lands, and they were given permission by the nobles to start these little towns, and that's where they started. The shtetl was usually a kahal had it, and this was generally uniform all over Europe. It was a few families, and they would take care of everything. The kahal, taxes, making sure anything that had to do with the city, the roads, you know, the cleanup, probably the shul. And the Chevra Kadisha, this was all done by the Kahal in every single shtetl. Now, some shtetls were very small. Some you had barely, you know, 10, maybe you'll have 10, 15 families. Other shtetlach, you could have 50, 100. And they were all over Europe. Okay, there's something that developed in Poland called the Council of the Four Lands. Sometimes it was four lands, sometimes it was three lands, sometimes it was five lands. But basically, it was all really the same area. It was Poland, Lithuania was one of them, Poland, and Poland was broken down into Greater Poland and Lesser Poland, and I think then came to the right, which would be today, which would be more Ukraine. Sometimes when Lithuania, I think, broke off and had their own for a while, so it was called three, sometimes it was called five. It was basically the same area, but sometimes they just would call it at different numbers. They just divided it differently. But this became the representative of all of Poland. And it was an amazing, amazing setup. The setup was is that there was a fair that would happen twice a year. One in Lublin, and the other in Yaroslav. Okay, we'll have it on another. And basically, this was there. The Vad Arba, they would meet. The Vad Arba Artzos would meet. I guess they had all throughout the year. But they were especially active during these two fairs, the winter fair and the summer fair. And they met in two different areas. And the fair, that's everybody came there for who knows what, for business, for shidduchim, for yeshivas. And they had the Vat Arba Konfos, they were the governing body of all the Jews in Poland. So anything that had to be taken care of, it was taken care of by the Vat Arba Arzos. And, you know, they had Gedolim there, they had, it was under the best rulers, the best was leading the Vat Arba Arzos.
The four lands, were they different countries?
Well, the four lands was all Poland. It was just how you divided it up. I'm not sure if this is Poland cut, and this is the Poland Gadol, this is the Great Poland, this is the Small Poland, Volin, Lublin. I'm not sure. This is just an old map. I just thought I'd just copy it. I was trying to study it. I didn't get a chance to really figure it out well. This is actually taken from a sefer in the beginning of the book. It was printed in Poland. I don't know if it was talking a little bit about the history, but it had some sort of this map, and these are all written in Yiddish. These. So I thought when I first took it that I know that there was Poland Katan and the Greater Poland and Lesser Poland, and Volin, we're probably over here. Lithuania is up here somewhere. Again, I'm not sure. I didn't study it too well, so I have to figure it out more. But that's it. But it really was all from Poland. So all Poland would get together. And this, the Vat Arba Arzos, they would make laws for all the Jews. They set up courts all over. They would make laws. They would represent the Jews to the government. So, so this is a sefer written, a sefer Yavan HaMetzula, written by Rav Nosson Nota Hanover. We quoted from him last week. He writes all about the Tach V'Tach, the Chmelnytsky's, revolt and the disaster, and he writes all what happened. He was there, he was running for his life. He says, at the fairs, the Rosh Yeshiva, together with the students of the yeshiva, older, younger, would go to the fair. In the summer, they would travel to Zaslo in Yaroslav, that's in Galicia, and in the winter, it was in Lvov, Lemberg, and Lublin. At every fair, hundreds of Rosh Yeshivas, many thousands of Bachrim, and many myriads of young students. We mentioned last time that you had the structure of the yeshiva, you had yeshiva, you had older bachrim, and every bachur was in charge of two younger bachrim, and they would be put up in wherever the yeshivas were, and there were many all over, in the towns of the shtetlach, they were put in houses, and they were given support by the families. They were in attendance, there were in attendance Jewish and non-Jewish merchants as plentiful as the sand at the seashore. From one end of the world to the next, people would come to the fair. One who had a son or a daughter to marry would travel there and make a match. Each one would find what they're looking for. Hundreds of matches would be made at each fair, at times thousands. The country of Poland was like Yerushalayim before its destruction, when courts were set up in every city. If one refused to be judged by the court of his city, he went to the nearest court. And if he refused to be judged by the nearest court, he went before the great court. The great court would meet at the big fairs. There's a, I don't know if I have it up here, but there's a, I think there's a, it's a marsha that he writes at the end, I don't remember where it was, but the marsha writes at the end of a perek, he doesn't write a pirish on the last two daf, and he says, I'm sorry, but I since I wasn't in the yeshiva, I had to go to the fair, so I am not writing, the yeshiva went the next two dot plot without me, or whatever. I don't feel, even though I have what to say, but I didn't learn it in the yeshiva. It didn't pass the test. We didn't go through it in the yeshiva, therefore, from here to the end of the perek, I'm not writing anything. So, he writes, in the capital of Ostrog, there was the great court of Volinia. And the Ukraine, with the capital of Lvov was there. There were thus many communities of which had a great court of its own. And if the important communities had a dispute between themselves, they would let themselves be judged by the head of the council of the four lands. But, you have smaller courts and bigger courts. What happens if two cities had a dispute among themselves? It could have been a a dispute in merchants and business, and maybe Hasagas Kavul, or whatever. Then they would wait for the fairs, and they would meet the Abba Arzels would have their functioning courts in the big towns. May their rachamim be reserved. Who would be in session twice a year? One leader would be chosen from each important community. That in terms of who would be on the court, on the Bad Arba Arzos big court, and added to these were six Gaonim from the land of Poland, and these were known as the Council of the Four Lands. Okay, so you had six, I guess, full-time Gedolim there, plus a representative from every land. I guess that was the Bad Arba Arzos to begin with. Up there, they would have a court. I don't know if these six were on the court, or they would get Gedolim from all over to join the court. The representative of the Four Lands had sessions twice a year. He said that between Purim and Pesach. Okay, I think I did this. The leader of the Four Lands resembled the Sanhedrin. They had jurisdiction over all Jews in the kingdom, with power to issue injunctions and binding decisions to impose penalties to their discretion. Every difficult case was submitted to them for trial. To make the task easier for them, the representatives of the Four Lands would select special judges from each land, who were called district judges, tried the civil suits, while criminal cases, disputes over priority of position, which is chazaka. So criminal cases and chazaka and other difficult cases were tried by the big court itself. There, I guess, there were lots of people would wait for the fairs to be judged, so they could be swamped by hundreds of cases. So the big court would set, you know, smaller courts which would deal with the smaller matters or easier matters, and then if it had to do with the bigger matters, which was community, criminal, so that was all dealt with the bigger courts. So they had a tremendous system. You know, never was a dispute. This is again all Rav Nosson Natan Hanover. Never was a dispute among the Jew before a guy, a nobleman, a king. He was punished and chastised severely. Every community appointed men in charge of weights and measures and of other business dealings, so everything would be conducted according to truth and trustworthiness. That's how you set up your... Everything in the community was all done kadasa kadin. There was a court in every community. There was a rav in every community. We spoke last week about the rav of the community, the Rosh Hashiva of the community. So this was a Torah-run community. Yeah, this is how it was. Opening inscription of a volume of Talmud that was printed in 1559, with the full agreement of all of the Gaonim and Rosh Yeshivas of the three lands. I guess at that time they had three lands: Poland, Russia, and Lithuania. That could be that it was really the same. It could be Poland was just broken down into two parts. They instituted a binding enactment that every yeshiva throughout the three lands should study one tractate after the next as they are being printed, with the help of Hashem, in order to spread Torah in Israel and in order to strengthen our hands in this holy work. What was happening is this is the time when the Gemaras were first being printed. The printing press first came onto the scene in the 1460s, 1480s. It didn't start hitting the Jewish scene until the beginning of the 1500s. And now the original press, the Socino press, only did about half the volumes. So then there was one or two other printing presses that were going to do the rest of the Gemaras. So what they were doing is they were printing a new Gemara, and then sell it. So what they wanted in Poland, what the Vod said is, okay, they would check with the printing press which Gemara is coming out now. Baba Kama, this year, every yeshiva is going to learn Baba Kama. So that helped business, it helped everything, it helped the printing presses, it helped everything. Because if they're printing out Baba Kama, it was very costly, and they couldn't sell it, you know, because all the yeshivas are learning Baba Metzia, then it's not good for the printing presses, and they don't have money to go on with the next volume. So the Vod Arba Arzos decided what they're learning in order to help, you know, once the new printing, you know, it's almost like when Art School came out with Daf Yomi, you know, they were working, see, that worked differently, that worked the opposite. Art School cheshbind when, you know, they took him like, say, I don't know, 3-4 months to come out with a new volume. I don't know, let's say 4 months to come out with a volume. So they figure, okay, 4 months from now, they're going to be up to Chulin. So we better get the, you know, start now with Chulin, you know. Okay, so that's basically, again, what was printed. This is a Tshuvas of the Ramah. So again, I'm not sure if we just go through, but again, the reason why I'm bringing it in is because he talks about the Vad, the court, in the some time already elapsed since two leaders of their respective cities together stood before the leaders of the land, negotiated an agreement. But it's been some time, okay, and therefore an accusation they should of all three lands in those situations, members of the larger city can some of the measures. This is what he's saying, some agreement that was made before the big court in the old in the Vad Arba Arzos, in the big court. With this, I will conclude. Again, this is another Ramah. For his honor, showed me the proofs which he wrote to the judges of the three lands. It was not effective, however, and they ruled in the manner which they desired. That's it. I heard your proofs. You told them the proofs, and they paskined against you. Okay, that was just, again, he mentioned the all of the. This is a Pinkus. This is a record book that was in the Council of Lithuania before the year 1569. So this is how they wrote. This is how they wrote there. We chose 9 heads of lands, 3 rabbis from every fair. Okay, 9 heads of lands and 3 rabbis. In every fair in Lublin, three of the heads together with one of the rabbis shall sit in session, oversee the general welfare. In our communities, neither caused by us nor from the government, they should stand to watch, see common good, and punish the evildoers, rebels, and those who steal or lie, both to Jews and non-Jews alike, in the name of heaven should not be desecrated. Okay, that's what, I guess, what they wanted the court to do. We also enacted every fair. The head should choose 3 judges to be prepared to judge between their fellow Jews in all cases. The decisions will be binding, and again, whether it be an issue of a large or a small sum, next, another one, same thing. Whoever shall willfully not listen to them be excommunicated. Now, excommunicated in Poland in those days really meant something, because if you're excommunicated and there's a Bezdin in every city, and there's a rav in every city, and you can't be buried or married or the sheikhet or the mail. Everything is all dependent on the community. Excommunication in Poland really meant something. It was a serious threat. You know, as the years went on, and the religious community did not have as much power, as the Jews became more secular and they became more accepted, or at least being able to go into the outside world more, so the excommunication was not as effective. We've granted a petition, elders Tikhtin. Oh, you see, this here's a case where Tikhtin, they wanted in. We're a big town now. We feel we deserve more representation. So representation of the 4 councils, we have accepted, ceded to their request that they be allowed a representative from this time forward for all generations. Again, these are the words of the council. Okay, so again, this was on the ledger books, what was brought before the case. Okay, this is something very, an interesting story. We have a legend. I don't know if anybody heard of the legend of a king for a day, like a story. So this is the story. There is a, it has to do with a person named, the name of Shaul Wal. Now, Shaul Wal happened to have been a tremendous shtadlan. He was a very wealthy Jew, a frum, he was a rav, you know, he was a Talmud Chacham, and he was a shtadlan. He worked with all the nobles and the princes to try to help the Jews out. He gave tremendous amount of tzedakah. This is how he became a shtadlan. And what happened is there happened to have been a prince by the name of Nicholas Radziwill. Okay, that was his name. Now, there's different stories on how he ended up in England, in Italy. one story, he ended up in Italy. He wanted to do tshuva, so he went to the Pope, and he said to the Pope, he says, listen, Pope, what do I do for tshuva? I want to become... So the Pope says, you know what? Get rid of your slaves and wander like a beggar for a few years. And then, you know, that's it. That'll be your penance. So he did it. That's according to one version. Another version is he was going from place to place and he just got mugged. He took all his money. But in any case, he ended up in Padua, Italy. And he now had to get home to his place, his palace in Germany. And he didn't have a penny to his name. He was all alone. So he started to go to people, and nobody gave him the time of day. They didn't believe him, whatever. He came upon the Rav of the city. Did I do it over here? Rav Shmuel Yehuda Katzenelenbogen. He was the Rav of Padua. He took him in. I believe you. You're the prince. No problem. Well, how much do you need? Like, you know. So he wrote him out a check or whatever. He gave him the money that he needed, all the money he needed to get back home. So the... It could be the Rav just never expected to get paid back. But he said the prince, I guess in the first story, if Radziwill, if he really was doing it for tshuva, you know, Mustami, he'd want to pay back, right? Because he's a whatever. But in any case, he says, how do I pay you back? So the Rav, Rav Shmuel Yehuda Katzenelenbogen, said, I have a son learning in yeshiva in Poland, not far from your palace. Look him up, and pay him back the money. And that's what he did. He went, one version is he showed him a picture of what his son looked like. Well, I guess he told him his name, he told him where the yeshiva, I think he was in Brisk, he was learning in the yeshiva there. So after he got back home, he went to look for Rav Katzenelenbogen's son, Rav Shoal. And he found him, and he started talking with him. When he saw him, he was very, very impressed with him. He was brilliant, he was smart. And he says, you know what, you're working for me, come. And he set him up on his palace, in his estate, and he set him up with a yeshiva, with what to learn. And he became his, advisor. And this since and from that point, Shaul Katzenelenbogen became a shtadlan. He had dealings with all the princes and nobles. Okay, and that's how he became a shtadlan.
The prince Radziwill. Do you know if he was an ancestor of Jackie Kennedy?
I don't know. I didn't check that out. We could probably Google it and find out. I would hope not, but maybe. I wouldn't say I hope not. I don't know. Whatever. But it's on the tape, you know. So I have no idea. I have no idea. All right. Anyway, so now what happened? Okay. So now here's the story. So King Stefan Batory died in 1586, and there were two factions. These Muskies and the Zabruskis. And they're each trying to figure out who should be the king. And this group wanted this, and this group wanted that. The problem was it was getting late in the day, and it seems that there was some sort of law in the books that you can't leave Poland without a king. You need a king. That's it. Just the country needs a king. So the problem was is who's going to be a king, because if you pick one side to be the king, that's it. He's not going to step down tomorrow. You bring the other side to be a king. So he figured, who's going to be the king? So this Radziwill get up. He says, I got the perfect person. I got this person. His name is Rav Shaul. And let him be king. He wants to be king like a hole in the head. And, you know, that's it. He'll be the king. And sure enough, he became king for one night. And they all said, do I have it over here? They couldn't agree. There was an existing law that they had to have an outsider, a temporary king. And Radziwill, one version is they first offered it to Radziwill, and he refused, but he says, I got a better person. And Shaul's name was Solomon, proposed, and I guess they knew him. They knew him to be a man of integrity. I guess they knew him as a Jew. He wasn't going to want to be king tomorrow. You know, he had no... He didn't want to be king, and they didn't want him to be king, so it wasn't going to be an issue. And they said, long live King Saul. And that's it. He was a king. Some say for one night, some say for a few nights, until they figure out who the next king was. Wall in, I guess, Polish or German, I'm not sure, it means election. So they got the name Saul Wall. Yeah, some say one day, some say a few days. That's the king for a day. That's, you know, so just an interesting story. Now, there's no historical record of this, right? So, you know, somebody will say, never happened. And all right, so maybe it never happened, but that's a legend. Mm-hmm. There was an outside confirmation of a historian, Gustav Karpeles, that writes about this Radziwill. He writes about him that, in fact, he made a pilgrimage to Jerusalem, and he was attacked by robbers, and nobody would help him except a Jewish merchant. And he gave him money, and he helped them get him back. So based that, at least historically, they do know about him. So that definitely could fit in. The Jewish merchant could have been the Rebbe of Katzenelnbogen. Okay, you know, that much of this whole story, that we do know. Okay, Council of the Four Lands, what was some of their, I mentioned, but some what was some of their jobs that they did? They defended the Jews against blood libels. Okay, even though there was not too many in that time against, again, the church was not as powerful back then as it was in the other countries. So they also took action against false Mashiachs like Shabtai Tzvi and Yaakov Frank. They supervised Jewish book printing. They were the contacts between the community and the government, done by a Kahal Appointee, a Shtadlan. So again, these were things that, this is what you would want, you know, like, instead of some nobody, you know, looking for his own personal honor or personal gain, dealing with the government or not knowing what the real needs of the Jewish community are, you have the Vod, being the ones representing the Jews. Okay, what were they engaged in? They were engaged in they were the ones to manage the lands of the princes, the nobles. That's who they were, you know. So the Poland, they didn't want to spend all day, all their entire time going to people, knocking on doors, you know, on the peasants, where's my money, where's, you know, pay up, where's the rent, where's everything. That they left to the Jews to do. They were busy playing golf or whatever they played back then. So that's what they want. So that's the first thing. So again, the nobility was very, very, they wanted the Jews there, and they were very helpful, you know, that it was in their best interest to have Jews. Jews would lease and manage land, especially lumber. It was known Jews were in the lumber industry. They were in the forests. They would chop the lumber down. I guess they would replant the trees. That was known as a Jewish occupation. And they also, at the beginning at least, they had the alcoholic beverages. So they had the taverns. They would have like the motels, and the goyim from the town would come into the Jewish tavern, and that's where they would get their beverages. So they had, those are the main three, and money. Those three, managing the estates, lumber, beverages, and lending money. Those were the main things. The relationship between the Polish nobles and the Jews. Jews served as skilled agents. They managed their estates, and they opposed no Jews were thinking ever of overcoming and taking out the shtetl. Was built again. We mentioned it was built on the property of the Polish nobles. The shtetl usually was a Jewish majority, and Jews and peasants would meet at the market town, either in the shtetl or outside the shtetl, but that's where, you know, the Jews, that's where they would buy and do your daily buying and selling. This is very different than Western Europe, because Western Europe, the Jews assimilated. Rashi spoke French. The Tosafos spoke French. In Germany, they spoke Yiddish, which is similar to Germany, so the Jews spoke German as well. In Poland, they had not want at all to assimilate with the Poles. They saw them as uncouth, as low, and they wanted to have nothing to do with them, to such a point they didn't even speak Polish. very often, if the guy wanted to speak with the Jews, they had to
learn Yiddish.
They had to learn Yiddish, you know. So you could have like this Polish, you know, thing. You know, the Yiddish, like, you know, no, a tenta, tenta. And he says, Ach bin a, and there's the Yid. And oh, yeah, oh, we got one, like, screaming, I'm not a Yid in Yiddish. I'm a, but that's it. Okay. So, okay, but again, the shtetl life, it was a Torah life. There was nothing, there was no outside influences. It was learning from the morning to the evening. There was, you went out, you learned before you went out, you learned when you came home. There was a shul, there was a rav, there was a yeshiva. Okay, the decline with the bigger cities, new ideologies, and revolts. But this is all going to change, start to change after 1643. After Khmelnytsky's revolt, things are going to change. Poland becomes from the mid 1500s on, up until the mid 1500s, if somebody wanted to send his son wanted to learn in one of the major yeshivas, he would leave Poland and either go to Germany, go to Padua, Italy. There were big yeshivas in Germany. There were big yeshivas, but in the middle of the 1500s on, that's it. The big yeshivas were now in Poland. The Polish yeshivas rival that of Germany. And shortly after that, the Germans and Italians would go to Poland to get the big yeshivas. Yeah, by the end of the 16th century, 15 Torah academies, 17th century Jews in Germany the other way. In the 1600s, the Jews in Germany would send their son to Poland. So Poland really took over, took everything. Ashkenaz, Yiddish, we did this, spiritual values, Hasidic Ashkenaz. That was the, they felt that they're the heirs or the continuation of the of Ashkenaz, of German Jewry. I'm sorry?
In terms of the davening, did they daven Ashkenaz?
Yes, Ashkenaz. Definitely Ashkenaz. So what's going to happen is Nusach Sfarad, which is what the Hasidim daven, didn't come into being until the Hasidim, which is not going to come. Baal Shem Tov was in the mid-1700s, you know, late 1700s, early 1800s. When the Hasidic movement came in, that's when they took the Ashkenaz and they wanted to make it more Kabbalistic. Just like Nusach Ari, you know, changed a little bit from the Sfarad Nusach, made it Kabbalistic. So the Hasidim are going to do the same thing to Ashkenaz. So that's right now. But right at this point, is basically only Ashkenaz.
At this point, so when did this Sfarad come in?
Well, Sfarad is we're on the other side of the world. Sfarad is developing as well. Spain was Sfarad, and what happened is in 1492, when they got expelled, exiled, most of them made it to the Turkish Empire. Turkey, which is maybe south of Poland and like more east. So now you're going to have two big communities. Turkish Jews, which are mostly Sfarad. Now, I wouldn't say mostly Sfarad, but had a big influence from Sfarad. And then Ashkenazim, which are now in Poland. So the Sfarad is going on at the same time in Turkey. That was more like last year. During this time, Sfat was big, and that's where the Beis Yosef and was there, along with the Ari, and so this was going on at the same time. Just a few Rabbanim. We'll speak about them more. The Marsha, 1510, Rav Moshe Isserles. Rafaim Lynchitz, he was the Klayakar, Meir Lublin, the Bach. So these are all these are about this time, and this is the time when everything is working well. And there's money. It's a wealthy community. They have cooperation with the princes, with the kings, and everything is working well. So Torah is now exploding, and the amount of scholarship, and the amount of things that are going on, it's all happening now. When you look at the Shulchan Aruch, right? So this is the Shulchan Aruch is all being developed. Take a look. You open up. I don't have one here. If you open up like a the Beis Yosef, you open up a Torah Shulchan Aruch or a Shulchan Aruch. You look at all of the Mefarshim, just about all of them. They're all from this period, because they could develop more when things are going good. So Torah thrives. Baruch Hashem, here in America, we see the same thing. You know, we have Baruch Hashem, we have a wealthy community, and Torah is thriving like never before. We probably have more full-time people learning here now than in Poland, probably. But I'm not sure. I don't know. But it's we're for sure rivaling that. Religious life begins to develop in Krakow, Lublin, Warsaw. These are the famous academies. The synagogues, shuls come everywhere. They dot the skyline or whatever. All up and down. Every shtetl has a shul, and all over you have the bigger cities have shuls as well. Again, managed by the Kal, they provide services, and they're the religious heads, and they take care of the way the shtetl looks, you know, cleaning the streets, etc. Did I have anything else? Yiddish we spoke about. Yeah, here it says it's Hebrew, Aramaic, and Slavic. Of course, it's mainly German, and So of course, anti-Semitism was always there, but in the first 150 years, it was not as much. You had the guilds. Now the guilds; these are the non-Jewish apprentices. The smiths, you know, the metalsmiths and the blacksmiths, all those types of works. They had very, very strict how you got in. You were apprenticed for a few years, and then you were able to open up by yourself. And when the Jews were trying to, you know, come in as well, so that caused competition, and not the type that was you know, good competition in terms for the Jews. The church also, the church also always accusing the Jews of desecrating the host, which is eating the wafers, and blood libels, killing kids and drinking their blood. And so the kings and the nobles in the beginning, they protected the Jews. The protection is going to not be so much. All right, we're probably going to... I have one more thing before I get to Chmelnytskyi massacres. But I'd like to talk about more the learning. Mm-hmm. So I don't know. I'm probably going to do that next week. Talk about Pilpul, because Poland came with a new type of learning. Okay, they I shouldn't say a new type of learning, but they put a lot of stress in something called Pilpul, which we'll talk about. What was Pilpul, and many people were against it, and what did the yeshivas look like? But then we're going to probably talk about Chmelnytskyi. He was again in 1648 to 1649 was the two worst years, but until they got, you know, it lasted a few years after that. Also, what was the decline? They never recovered from after the massacre. So they became poor and then overpopulated. Now then, once you don't have as much money, there's not enough money to go around, so the rich that have the money are at odds with the poor that don't have the money. So now you're going to have class, you know, fighting within the Poles. So not necessarily religious or not. It's not, you know, you could have religious poor people or religious rich people against the poor people, rich people, religious or not. It's not a religious thing. It's a class thing. They get invaded by Sweden, Russia. Everybody invades Poland. Polish, they need more taxes, so they need more money, but there's no more money in the Jews. They're not making money, so the Poles don't want to protect them as much. So things start to fall apart. Then late 1700s, Russia attacked. There was a certain time that Poland didn't exist. They chopped up Poland and they gave it to everybody. Russia took the east, Austria took the south, Prussia took the west, and So one of the big things is Russia took over Poland, so they weren't ready how to deal with all these Jews. The other two, Prussia and Austria, so they were working towards assimilating the Jews, letting, you know, figuring out how to deal with them. Russia did not. I guess this is really way, way down the road. So something else that I wanted to talk about. Yeah, so Russia took this, Austria, Prussia took that. Okay. Okay, Catherine, Pale of Settlements. Okay, that's pretty much, we'll talk more about that next time. Any questions?
Yes.
Okay, then Baruch Hashem. All right.